The end of the road for Trump's UN ambassador today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. President Trump's ambassador to the United Nations is stepping down. Nikki Haley has been a key U.S. voice on the international stage since Trump came into office, but she didn't always agree with the president.
Clearly, this has been somewhat of a rocky relationship over the last few months because of her differences with or her willingness to go beyond the Trump administration's policy in some cases.
Also, in much of the U.S., convicted felons can't vote, even after they've served their time. That's stricter than most countries.
Your liberty is supposed to be given back to you once you complete and pay your debt to society. That liberty comes with the eligibility to vote.
Those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Good to have you with us. Nikki Haley is out as U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. She announced her resignation today, effective the end of this year. Haley said it's been an honor of a lifetime to serve at the UN, and she ticked off a list of foreign policy accomplishments under President Trump.
Now the United States is respected. Countries may not like what we do, but they respect what we do. They know that if we say we're going to do something, we follow it through. And the president proved that, whether it was with the chemical weapons in Syria, whether it's with NATO, saying that other countries have to pay their share. I mean, whether it's the trade deals, which have been amazing, they get that the president means business and they follow through with that.
Haley was speaking there at the White House, seated next to the president. Trump spoke, too, praising Haley's diplomatic work at the UN.
And that was really the thing I think she did best at the United Nations. She got to know the players. She got to know China, Russia, India. She knows everybody on a very first-name basis, and they like her. Except for maybe a couple, which is normal, right? They can't all like you, but they do. They really like her, and I think maybe more importantly, they respect her.
Molly Montgomery has an insider view of U.S. diplomacy. She served as Vice President Mike Pence's special advisor for Europe and Russia before she left government earlier this year. She's now a vice president with the global business strategy firm Albright Stonebridge Group. So, Molly, we're still trying to figure out why Ambassador Haley resigned today. Essentially, she said it was time. What do you make of the timing of this resignation? Why now?
Well, the timing was somewhat of a surprise, Marco, but I do think it's no secret that Ambassador Haley's influence has been in decline since John Bolton took on his role as National Security Advisor. Nikki Haley is not someone who folds easily, I would say. And so the idea that if her role were significantly diminished by the arrival of Secretary Pompeo and John Bolton, that she would depart, I think is a logical next step.
Yeah, I mean, tell me more about the arrival of John Bolton, Trump's national security advisor, because he's reputed to throw his weight around and he's got strong views of the UN to boot. How well did he and Haley get along?
My understanding is that he certainly exerted more of an influence. He is a former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, and so this is somewhat of a pet issue for him. And during his tenure, he was famous, or rather perhaps infamous, for his dislike of the UN and his skepticism of multilateralism more generally.
You said her clout had been on the decline. Can you elaborate a little bit more on that?
During the early months of the Trump administration, Nikki Haley was really willing to push U.S. policy in areas particularly concerning Russia and Ukraine from her perch at the UN. And she was able to do that because there was a vacuum as Tillerson declined to engage with both allies and adversaries alike. And so as Secretary Pompeo moved over from the CIA, he has been much more willing to fill that traditional role. And I think that engagement has really closed the space for Nikki Haley to operate beyond just the UN.
Nikki Haley was pretty tough when it came to Russia, wasn't she?
She was, absolutely. Particularly, I would say, in the early months of the administration, there were several instances when she pushed the envelope in terms of the administration's rhetoric on Russia, particularly speaking about Russian aggression toward Ukraine and laying down some markers for the administration on that issue.
I'm just wondering if you caught any glimpses of Ambassador Haley in action at the UN, something that you spotted that you think maybe the rest of us might not have seen, something in the realm of diplomacy.
Well, I think Ambassador Haley was certainly very willing to take on board the idea that our allies are not necessarily our traditional allies, but those who are with us on a transactional basis. And we certainly saw that after the United States' recognition of Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, where she was very eager to reach out to and to reward countries that had voted with the United States, or at least not against the United States.
So when historians look back on Nikki Haley's tenure at the UN, what will they see?
I think they will see a UN ambassador who actually played a larger role than many have, particularly in Republican administrations where they often have not been of cabinet rank. And that she is somebody who pushed the envelope with the administration, potentially causing her own downfall.
Any thoughts on who might be on the short list for the job?
Well, I certainly would expect that it will be someone who has less of an independent political base and probably is a name that won't be quite as well known, since John Bolton and Secretary Pompeo are both likely to want to exert more influence over UN affairs. And so the next UN ambassador will find him or herself in a difficult position in that this administration has cut funding for many UN programs and has really voiced its opposition to multilateralism generally and to the UN in many ways. So certainly I would expect that any US perm rep will not be a popular figure in New York.
Molly Montgomery there. She served as Vice President Mike Pence's special advisor for Europe and Russia. She left the White House earlier this year. Brett Kavanaugh is starting a new job today. Kavanaugh heard his first arguments as a Supreme Court justice. This comes, of course, after a divisive nomination process. Politically, the big question now is how the battle over Kavanaugh's nomination might move voters in November. The midterms now are less than a month away. Both sides are hoping Americans will turn out in big numbers. What about Americans, though, who can't vote, like convicted felons? Most U.S. states don't let them vote. The World's Shirin Jafari tells us that the U.S. is just one of a few Western democracies that does this.
Salvador Solorio registered to vote as soon as he turned 18.
I voted in, you know, the municipal elections, the county elections, state elections, federal elections. Anytime I was in election, I was there.
He kept up with the news, went to city council meetings, wrote letters to local representatives. Politics was his jam. But Solorio's enthusiasm for civic engagement hit a wall in 1992 when he was sentenced to 18 years to life in prison for second-degree murder. It meant losing his right to vote, which some would say is an appropriate part of the punishment. More on that later. Solorio, who's at San Quentin State Prison in California, hasn't voted in 28 years.
I essentially lost my voice. You know, there's a sense of helplessness, you know, being cut off. You know, why would a politician listen to me? I'm a prisoner. I can't vote for him, so why would he even bother?
For years, courts around the globe have debated this question. Should someone who has committed a serious crime be allowed to vote? In 2002, Canada answered yes. It lifted its ban on prisoner voting. In Israel, courts allowed a man who assassinated the prime minister to vote. They argued that regardless of the crime, a person's criminal punishment should be separated from their rights as a citizen. Most European countries like Denmark, Finland, Ireland, Spain, and Switzerland let all prisoners vote.
What you see in Europe is much more of a surgical approach in many countries.
Nora Diemleitner teaches law at Washington and Lee University in Virginia. She has studied global prisoner disenfranchisement. She says in France and Germany, for example, courts may ban someone from voting, but that's part of the overall punishment. Say if the person has committed voter fraud or is convicted of terrorism.
The interesting part in Europe is that Eastern European countries tend to be much more restrictive. They tend to have longer disenfranchisement periods. They tend to be more inclined to disenfranchise everyone who is in prison.
But no need to look all the way to Eastern Europe to find places with blanket bans on prisoner voting, says Mark Maurer, head of the Sentencing Project. It's a nonprofit that advocates for prisoner rights in the U.S.
The United States is an extreme outlier when we look at voting rights in industrialized nations.
He says while each state has its own laws, almost all take away a prisoner's right to vote in national elections.
We have only two states, Maine and Vermont, that permit prisoners to vote along with others. And that's the only really comparable position to what many democratic nations currently proceed with.
And if you're in prison in states other than Maine and Vermont, then, well, you don't get to take part in elections. Where do these policies come from? Maurer says they're deeply rooted in American history.
There are periods of time, particularly after the Civil War, when many Southern states used their disenfranchisement policies specifically to target potential Black voters.
It wasn't until the late 90s, he says, when voting rights for prisoners got wider attention and groups like his started to look deeply at the issue.
And that helped to spur a movement for reform.
Maurer says opponents of these laws say they're outdated and disproportionately affect people of color. But
supporters will sometimes say, well, you broke the law and therefore you deserve some type of punishment, and punishment may include loss of the right to vote as well.
Maurer argues, why do prisoners lose some rights and not others?
You can still buy or sell property. You can get married or divorced. You can submit an op-ed article to the New York Times and possibly get it published.
Why then lose the right to vote? But here's where some states in the U.S. get even more strict compared to the Canada, France, and Germany's of the world. People with criminal records lose their right to vote even after completing their sentence.
This is what a lot of my friends tell me. I didn't know that. That's the first response. And the second one is, that's stupid.
Angel Sanchez was just 16 when he was sentenced to 30 years in prison in Florida. He says he joined a gang at a young age and got sucked into crime.
I lost my right to vote before I ever had the right to vote.
In prison, Sanchez started to turn his life around. He says his breakthrough came when he got a job at the prison library.
They gave me a desk and they gave me my own chair. And when I sat down, I felt important. Or as we would say in the streets, I felt official.
Sanchez spent hours at the library learning about disenfranchisement in the U.S. and elsewhere, like in South Africa.
They recently came out of apartheid. And after that, they said, yeah, we can't allow disenfranchisement or the snatching away of voting eligibility simply because someone gets incarcerated, because we know that the people in power could be part of the reason that people get incarcerated. Or the party in power would not care about the humanity and the importance of these individuals if they're not voting.
Sanchez, who's now out of prison and a law student, says that's what's happening in Florida today. He says by telling people who have served their sentence they can't vote, states are telling them they don't matter.
Your liberty, that's your punishment. You get arrested, you get incarcerated, you get held. When the time is up, you're let go. And so true liberty is supposed to be given back to you once you complete and pay your debt to society. That liberty comes with the eligibility to vote.
These laws might change in Florida. On the state's November ballot, there's something called Amendment 4. If it passes, it will restore former prisoners' right to vote. Nora Diemleitner, the professor in Virginia, is watching the elections closely.
I think it's going to be really crucial, because if that were to happen, that means a quarter of the people who are currently disenfranchised would be re-enfranchised.
This, she says, could change the election's outcome in Florida. Diemleitner thinks there's a good chance that Amendment 4 will pass. But given the long road it took to even get here,
I'd say to the world, don't follow the U.S. example. It's really not a good one. But on the other hand, I'd also add, we're working on it. And I think Florida's referendum is the example that we're trying to change.
She says, if Florida's law changes, it might spur other states to rethink who can and cannot vote. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Coming up, hotel workers join me too. You're tuned to the world. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with the world. Me Too sparked a global conversation about sexual assault and harassment that may have helped some women in the hotel industry achieve a goal they'd been fighting for a long time, getting their employers to do more to protect them from sexual assault. This made headlines a few years back when a hotel housekeeper accused Dominique Strauss-Kahn, the former head of the IMF, of sexual assault. That case was settled out of court, but the problem never went away. Here's the world's Allison Herrera.
Imagine this. You're a woman working in an office, and you're in the middle of a meeting. All of a sudden, your male coworker starts to undress. It's hard to imagine that happening, right? Well, if you're a hotel housekeeper, chances are it has happened to you.
You know, I knock 3 times, and I'm assuming, oh, no one's in the room, so I'm going to put my key in, I'm going to enter the room. So this particular time, you know, I knocked and entered this room, and this guest is standing there completely naked.
That's Latonia. She's a housekeeper at a large hotel in Chicago. She asked me not to use her last name or the name of the hotel where she works. She's worried about how speaking out might impact her job. She says that when this happened, she was more than just scared.
Like, it made me feel disgusted, angry. So I just kind of like bagged up and just left.
She reported it to her manager, but she says nothing was done.
So it's one of those things, it happens so much in housekeeping where your managers kind of feel like it was just normal. And they just say, okay, you don't go back to the room today.
But she did have to go back. She brought another woman so she wouldn't have to be alone. And fortunately, that guest wasn't there. But he wasn't asked to leave. So in 2016, when members of her union, Unite Here, wanted to ask her and her coworkers some questions about sexual assault on the job, she knew this was her chance to make change happen.
I'm like, oh, okay. And one of my coworkers was sitting next to me, and she was like, you know, just kind of nudged me like, you know, why are they coming talking about sexual harassment? And I'm like, this is our opportunity to kind of share things that we deal with every day.
Latonia and other housekeepers in the union set out to survey more than 500 women about their experiences on the job. Nearly 60% of women they talked with dealt with some form of assault by a hotel guest. That led to action. Last year, housekeepers in Chicago successfully lobbied for a device to keep them safe. It's called a panic button, and it was part of a citywide campaign known as Hands Off, Pants On. So this is one solution.
See, it sent a message that I was in danger in the room.
That's Arifa Hojic. She's the head of housekeeping at the Witt Hotel. She shows me how the safety device works. Press the button, and hotel security is on the way.
Housekeeping.
Hojic emigrated here from the 90s, from what was then Yugoslavia. She's always worked as a housekeeper. Her story is not uncommon. According to a study done by the American Immigration Council, the top occupation for foreign-born women here in the U.S. is housekeeping, with nearly 900,000 women working in this sector. For Hojic, having the panic button has made her and her staff safer.
I honestly think it's a great thing.
It is great that Chicago hotels are required to give this device to housekeepers, but sexual assault in the hotel industry is a global issue. So what are some of these larger chains like Marriott doing to keep their workers safe, say in Paris or Dubai?
There's such heightened awareness around safety and security, so we're dialing up in this space. But I think it's important to remember there's no one magic answer.
That's Erica Alexander. She's the chief lodging services officer for Marriott International. She's talking about the new devices they're rolling out in the U.S. and Canada. But the company has no current plan to put panic buttons into the hands of their workers in other countries.
That, for us, is a huge problem because we understand that, you know, the Marriott brand should be doing the right thing, whether they're here in the United States or around the world.
That's Kathy Feingold. She's the international director of the AFL-CIO. She says that back in June, housekeepers from Chicago presented at an international labor conference in Geneva. They inspired other housekeepers working in South Africa and around the globe to push for a hands-off, pants-on campaign.
If there's a best practice that's happening here in the United States and Marriott can do it here in the United States, they can do it in China where they have massive investment and expansion. They can do it throughout Asia, throughout Latin America.
Before the Me Too movement last year, housekeepers like Latonia didn't have much of a voice when it came to safety on the job. They'd been trying for years to get their employers to protect them.
And then all of a sudden, all of this stuff started showing up in the news. And I'm just like, this is incredible. I'm like, because we had all had the same feeling, like we've started something.
And they have. Five of the major hotel chains have promised to install panic buttons in all their hotels nationwide by 2020. But for so many people around the globe working as housekeepers, there's no button they can press to stop them from being assaulted on the job. For The World, Allison Herrera, Chicago.
Hey, enough already with the phone scams. You know, a stranger asking you for your credit card number claiming they're from some company. This story is about someone who actually worked for a scammer and decided to do something about it. Thing is, it took 20 years. In 1998, Jacqueline Stone went to work at a call center in British Columbia in Canada. At the time, she was a teenager. Here's Stone in an interview with the CBC recalling how she landed the job.
A bunch of my friends were hired at a telemarketing room, and they were offered a lot of cash bonuses. So word got around really quickly amongst our friends. So I went and got a job there, and we were basically hired to call people and offer them credit card fraud protection. It became very clear pretty quickly that we were only calling senior citizens. We were only calling people in the United States. We were instructed to lie to them about where we were located. And they were basically then ripping off the credit card. We didn't know, but it started to become pretty clear. So I still wanted to make the money. So I would call these people and then I would warn them to check out the company's name and make sure they do their research before giving their credit card number to anybody on the phone. I don't know. I was so upset about it, and I wanted action, and I wanted justice. So I went down to the police station and I reported it. But, you know, basically they just told me that investigations take time. And I really thought, you know, we were all going to march back up the hill and go arrest this guy. But they just said, no, it's going to take a lot of time and a lot of research before they could do that. So I was a little bit disappointed. I finally got to testify when I was 36 years old, literally 20 years. You know, I was always a bit of a rebel. I pushed boundaries. When this happened, you know, I was 16 years old and I was living on my own in White Rock because I thought I was invincible and I knew everything. But I was raised to stick up for people and to not let something like that just go by.
Whistleblowing in very slow motion. That's Jacqueline Stone telling her story to the CBC's Jason Proctor. Stone's former boss, Mark Wilson, was sentenced last month to 11 years in prison for cheating senior citizens out of more than $18 million. I'm Marco Werman. How's it feel when you're 8 years old and you pull an ancient sword from a lake in Sweden?
It feels very cool.
And then how do you let the world know about it?
Daddy, I found a sword!
I know so many questions for Saga Vanacek and her dad, Andy. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Every country has an ugly side to its history. So it is with Australia and its so-called stolen generation. The name comes from the half-century-long policy of taking Aboriginal children from their homes and placing them with white families. The practice stopped in the 1970s, but now some Aboriginal people are wondering if it's starting up again. This time they're talking about social service workers removing children from their homes. The government says they're dealing with violence and abuse within these families, but some say the government is risking another stolen generation. Tipa Fernandez has our story from the city of Alice Springs.
Hello, I'm Shirlene Campbell. I'm a Central Australian mother of five.
Campbell has a shy smile, and she grips her cup of tea tightly as we talk.
I watch domestic violence all the time. If it's not my mum and dad, it would be our family members.
And then it happened to her.
Yep, I was a victim.
Physical and verbal abuse from her husband.
Well, with me going through domestic violence myself, at the end of the day, if you're having violence and at the end of the day, it can break up families and it's not a good thing. Pretty daunting for the kids as well.
One horrific case of family violence made national headlines earlier this year when a 2-year-old Aboriginal girl was raped in her home.
Residents are also asking questions about how the child was allowed to remain in a house they say was well known to police and child protection agencies. "We're devastated and angry," one resident told Sky News. "If I could have, I would have stolen that child myself."
It's a loaded issue here. Did you catch that the resident wanted to steal the child to keep her safe? That's a blunt reference to a shameful part of white Australia's treatment of Aboriginal people when authorities literally did steal Aboriginal children and put them in group homes or place them with white families. In 2008, the Prime Minister issued a national apology to what's called the Stolen Generation. Yet a case like the rape of the toddler led even some Aboriginal leaders to call for more aggressive actions in removing children from violent homes. Here's an Aboriginal councilwoman from Alice Springs, Jacinta Price, talking to Sky News Australia soon after the rape.
"This situation has become really quite bad, and, you know, this stigma around a second stolen generation, I believe, is one of the main reasons why these children are faced with what they're faced with, because we haven't intervened when we should have to save the lives of these children."
"I feel angry and sad, you know, that all these, not all Aboriginal people are like that."
Wiona Palmer is from an Aboriginal community near Alice Springs.
"You can't just say that Aboriginal people are violent and, you know, can't look after their children. We know how to grow our kids up."
As Palmer and I chat, her 6-year-old daughter is curious about my microphone, so I hand it to her, and she Hello. Points it at her own grandmother.
"What's your name?"
"Lakayla."
"And what's the other little school you go to?"
"Children's Ground."
Lakayla's grandmother, Felicity Hayes, is a big part of her life. She helps teach Lakayla her mother tongues.
"How do you say that in Aranda?"
"Mbakana'ala."
She speaks 3 languages. She speaks English, Western Aranda, and Pijinjara.
Learning language and culture is key to what Palmer means when she says we know how to grow our kids up.
"We're worried about our young children too when they get taken away from us, because we don't know what could happen to them behind closed doors."
Palmer has had first-hand experience. Authorities removed her niece and nephew due to family violence in the home a decade ago. They took her nephew hundreds of miles away and placed him in another state.
"And he was staying in a farm for 9 years.
How did you find him?"
"He found us. He had to run away because of what was happening to him behind closed doors. So he decided to make a run, because they would say bad things to him and lock him up in the bedrooms and say that his family doesn't exist, that he was just a boy that got taken away from a drunken person."
They managed to get custody of his sister and raise her, but it's been traumatizing for all of them, even now that they have their nephew back. I wanted to ask the Department of Family and Community Services about the case, but they declined to talk to me.
"All Aboriginal communities affirm that our kids have to be safe."
Tim Ireland heads the largest Aboriginal child protection agency in the state of New South Wales.
"When you look at the options that are available to Aboriginal women experiencing domestic violence, really over the years, those options have been cut down. I mean, in the past, we would have women's refuges and shelters and refuges for families, so women with children."
Those shelters do exist, but few are run by Aboriginal communities, and Ireland says a lot of women just don't trust them. What they get instead, according to Ireland, is
government pulling out a big stick and saying, "Well, you've reported this now. We're going to penalise you by removing your partner and locking them away and doing all that, and then also taking your kids because you couldn't keep them safe." That's the wrong response.
The government's numbers show that Aboriginal children are much more likely to be removed from their families than non-Indigenous kids. And there's been a big spike in those numbers. They've almost doubled over the past decade.
"The policies of the past that led to the stolen generation are being played out in Australia, so using a child protection kind of lens."
In the Northern Territory, the state where the toddler was raped, it's even higher. The number of children removed has tripled in the past decade.
"There's definitely overrepresentation of Aboriginal children entering into the child protection system."
Colleen Gwynn is the Children's Commissioner of the Northern Territory. Her job?
"I'm employed by government to oversee all services to vulnerable children."
So I asked her why there's been such a dramatic increase of Aboriginal children removed in her state, when the number of non-Indigenous children removed has remained relatively stable.
My view is that that's directly attributed to a number of determinants such as poverty, overcrowding, drug and alcohol misuse, violence. It's not a quick fix. These are issues that will take many, many years to overcome.
I'm in a park in Alice Springs, a Sunday picnic with a group of women, Aboriginal grandmothers. They're starting to come together to demand that their Indigenous children be kept within larger family networks.
Hello, my name is Sabella Kwarai-Turner in Central Australia, Alice Springs.
Turner belongs to the local chapter of Grandmothers Against Removals.
You know, I've had a lot of families removed from my family with their family conferencing, and it's still happening today.
The law requires social service workers to make every attempt to place Aboriginal children in a family network. But Turner and other women here tell me they were never asked to take in a grandchild or a nephew. Children's Commissioner Colleen Gwynn says they're aware that at times they could be doing a better job of this. Isabel Turner has this suggestion.
Look, if they don't know how to do their job, these children family services, they should get people like us grandmothers to do their job, you know, or work together.
But it's not all bleak, I'm told, by Charlene Campbell, the mother we met at the beginning of the story. We're at an all-day Australian rules football tournament in Alice Springs. She has four sons and all play football. They're really good too. Campbell did not want her kids to grow up in a violent home, and she didn't want to risk losing them. She knew she had to do something to keep her family together. So she enlisted the women in her family to help her make her husband see how wrong his violent behaviour was.
My husband actually turned things around knowing that I needed his support as well.
Campbell is part of a women's group called Tunnanjira that's pushing local and federal government to fund family support services and support Aboriginal mothers so they can end the cycle of violence. She says her husband has seen the light. Now he goes around talking to other men.
He goes out to the communities talking about domestic violence, you know, men don't hit their partners, they're not real men if they do that. Real men stand up and support their wives. Real men always be equal with the partner.
One mother can't do it alone, Campbell says, so she and other community organisers are building the support networks so other families can stay together too. For The World, Deepa Fernandez, Alice Springs, Australia.
We have photos of those women in Deepa's story and of life in Alice Springs. Find them at theworld.org. Tomorrow, Deepa brings us a story of another group of Aboriginal women whose ancient wisdom is bringing modern land management to the outback. Gathering intelligence can take you to the far ends of the earth, remote villages in Russia, for example. But getting intel can also be as easy as going online and doing a few searches. The investigative news websites Bellingcat and The Insider did both, and in the process managed to reveal the likely identity of one person allegedly involved in the poisoning of a former Russian military intelligence officer and his daughter in the UK. The suspect's name is Dr. Alexander Mishkin. According to the investigation, he's a trained military doctor who worked for the GRU, Russian Army Intelligence. Eric Toller is one of the Bellingcat reporters who worked on this case. You went through a pretty lengthy process to identify Alexander Mishkin. What clues did you actually have to work with?
Well, we had a little bit to start with just from the information that Russia had released and also the British authorities had released about the cover identities of this guy. So we now know his real name is Alexander Mishkin. But before he was Mishkin, he was known as Alexander Petrov, which was his cover identity. This is, you know, a totally fake identity they made up out of nowhere for him to travel under. And so we had some information about that cover identity, including his birthday, where he had the passport issued to, which is this very small town in the middle of nowhere in northern Russia. So that was a good starting point.
So talk a bit more about that process, how you've got that starting point. Where do you go from there?
So we have the starting point of we can assume that he probably use some of the same information on his cover identity from his real identity. So he looked into a bunch of databases. Some of them are openly available. Some of them are leaked. Russia is a very corrupt and leaky society. And because of that, there's leaked databases from driver's licenses and insurance stuff and voter registration and addresses and stuff all over the internet you can find if you just know where to look. And so we cross-referenced everything we could find. And we found a match about a guy named Alexander Mishkin who had the same birth date and was from roughly the same village in the middle of nowhere in northern Russia. And after a bunch of digging, including actually sending someone to go to his tiny little village where he's from and finding locals who knew him, apparently he was a local DJ before he went wow. to medical school. Yeah, he DJed at the local club, the one club I'm sure they had in a tiny village. So we went for these hunches in these databases, cross-referencing the tiny bit of information we think would probably match the true identity of Mishkin.
I got to say, some of the steps in your process, you and your investigators really seem to have to put yourselves in the mindset of a spy.
Yeah, in a way. I mean, a lot of this is just a lot of very creative thinking, thinking of any vulnerabilities of what would leave a paper trail from a spy in Russia, right? So, you know, maybe not, you can't find his birth certificate, right? Because maybe that's all been forged and is hidden away forever. But again, these spies have real lives too. They have a family, they have kids. So you can find information that would track back to them. So, yes, maybe some of this is kind of spy work, but a lot of very, very basic routine research on the stuff you learn in, you know, high school or college of, you know, searching, looking for interesting details and cross-referencing them and see what matches up.
Now that you've got a name, what else were you able to find out about Dr. Alexander Mishkin? Like, do you have evidence that he was working on behalf of the Kremlin?
Yeah, I mean, this guy listed his registered addresses as the headquarters of the GRU, which when at first glance seems absolutely insane. Like, why would a secret spy list his public address, like on his driver's license, it's the address of the, you know, CIA, the equivalent of the CIA? Well, he did it because, you know, if he gets pulled over in his car, the cop pulls up his address and he sees the address of the, you know, the Russian CIA more or less. And he's like, oh, actually, you know, everything's in the up and up. You can just go, you know, you're fine. So we ran the address in a traffic database. And we found there's 305 men, all between the ages of 25 and 50, who all had the same registered address. So it just says one address in Moscow. So wow. All of these men almost certainly are officers of the GRU. And they all listed their vehicle registration as this address because they just don't want to pay traffic fines when they get pulled over. Or they get pulled over for drunk driving or speeding. The cop just lets them go, right? Because they don't want to mess with somebody in the intelligence services. So really, everything just goes down to laziness and, I guess, corruption in a way, too. And that's how a lot of the vulnerabilities of how we were able to research this played out.
So the headline in The Guardian on this news intrigued me. It said, string of own goals by Russian spies exposes a strange sloppiness. So what is your take on the possibility that this was not sloppiness, but intentional, that Russia wanted to leak who these men were?
I mean, I suppose that's always possible, right? Because, you know, every time any investigation turns up information in Russia, people always chime in saying, well, they wanted you to find it, right? Well, if they want us to find it, why has no one published this stuff before? Because, this, you know, these insurance registrations for these vehicles to the GRU headquarters, you know, they've been doing this for years and years and years and years and registering new agents to these addresses, same like GRU addresses. Again, it makes no sense when you think about it, but it all kind of boils down to, again, just corruption and laziness.
A few weeks ago, your website, Bellingcat, identified a second person allegedly involved with the Skripal poisoning. Have authorities in the UK or anywhere else been in touch with you about your findings?
No, not really at all. I mean, I don't really have any. I don't think Elliot, our founder, has any contacts with UK police either. So we don't know what they're thinking. For all we know, they discovered this all weeks and weeks ago. Or maybe it's just all completely news to them. We honestly have no idea.
You know, just listening to what you said about all the available data that is online, is it impossible to be a spy in the digital age?
It depends. I'm not a spy. I have no idea. I've never worked in intelligence services, but I'm sure you can do it in some ways, but it's much, much harder than it's ever been before.
That was Arik Toller with the news site Bellingcat. Together with their partners at The Insider, they say they've uncovered the identities of two Russian intelligence officers suspected of poisoning former Russian spy Sergei Skripal and his daughter Yulia in the UK back in March. Jair Bolsonaro says he will not soften his hardline rhetoric in order to get elected as Brazil's next president. But he may not have to. Bolsonaro pulled down 46% of the vote Sunday in the first round of the country's presidential election. That places a right-wing populist within easy reach of victory in the runoff later this month. If you're a Brazilian concerned about corruption and crime, that may be a good thing. Bolsonaro ran on a law and order platform. But if you're concerned about the future of the Amazon, probably not such a good thing. Last week, we heard several stories on The World from reporter Sam Eaton. They were about new troubles in the Amazon and why they matter to the whole world. So, Sam, bottom line, what is Bolsonaro's position on deforestation and other threats to the whole Amazon?
The headline here, Marco, is Bolsonaro's pledge to withdraw from the Paris Climate Agreement, which is huge when you consider Brazil is the seventh largest greenhouse gas polluter in the world, mostly from deforestation. But that's just the beginning of his kind of anti-environment rhetoric. He's made several promises which don't bode well for the future of the Amazon. Things like eliminating the Ministry of Science, which does a lot of the tropical forest research and its relation to the global climate. Rolling the Ministry of Environment, which includes the main police force that's charged with policing deforestation in the Amazon, rolling that into the Ministry of Agriculture, which promotes the expansion of soy and cattle ranching, the main drivers of deforestation in the Amazon. So huge conflict of interest there. Other things in the list include opening indigenous territories to mining. Indigenous territories in the Amazon represent about a quarter of the Amazon and have been a huge buffer against deforestation. He also would like to relax the environmental law enforcement, licensing so that it makes it easier to build roads and dams in the Amazon. So these are huge implications to the future of the Amazon forest.
Bolsonaro's opponent, Fernando Haddad, he's with the Workers' Party. What's his position on all this, and how likely is it that he could actually beat Bolsonaro?
I think the political pundits in Brazil are not giving him much of a chance. I mean, he basically need every single vote from the people who voted for the third and fourth place candidates in order to pull off a victory during the runoff election. But his views on the environment are definitely more mainstream for Brazil. He's very much emphasizing science, innovation, action on climate and environmental policies. He's promised to promote renewable energy, to fight deforestation, to maintain the protections for indigenous territories in the Amazon. Very much a different candidate when it comes to environmental views. The bottom line right now is that we need to be growing more trees, not cutting them down. And a Bolsonaro presidency would ensure that Brazil returns to some of the alarmingly high deforestation rates of the past.
Reporter Sam Eaton has been following events in Brazil and the Amazon for us. For more on why the fate of the Amazon matters, check out his stories at theworld.org/Amazon. And finally, everything that is old is new again. But is medieval new again? What you're about to hear suggests the answer is yes. Remember the legend of King Arthur and his sword Excalibur? Here's a quick recap, courtesy of Monty Python.
Well, how'd you become king, then?
The Lady of the Lake. Her arm clad in the purest shimmering samite held aloft Excalibur from the bosom of the water, signifying by divine providence that I, Arthur, was to carry Excalibur. That is why I'm your king.
Listen, strange women lying in ponds distributing swords is no basis for a system of government. Be quiet!
No kings in the story you're about to hear. We do have an ancient sword, though, estimated to be 1,500 years old. It was found this past summer in a lake in Sweden by the heroine of our story, 8-year-old Saga Vanacek.
Hi, my name is Saga.
Hi, Saga. I'd love to know what you were doing at this lake and how you actually found the sword.
Well, I was outside playing in the water, like I usually do, and then I like to throw rocks and sticks and stuff, so I was actually going to give Daddy, like, this floaty thing for the boat, so no other boats crash into this big cement thing, because the water was very low this year.
Yeah.
And I was going to give him that, because I was on land and I had my bathing suit on, and he was by the cement block. Then I was going to bring it to him, and I felt something sticking out from, like, I think it was like clay, a little bit like clay sand that it was under. And then I like pulled it and it was like, it had like a pointy end. And on the other side, it looked like a handle. And I'm like, Dad, I found a sword. Like, yeah. Then he came running and he took this sword from me and said, that looks very fragile. I don't know if you should hold it.
So this sounds like a really magical story, Saga. How do you feel about finding an ancient object like this?
Well, I feel very happy, and it's interesting and fun.
Who have you told this story to?
Just my friend, Emmy, that I can trust because she didn't say anything to anybody else. I wasn't allowed to say anything because there can come people that want stuff for themselves and dig there at night, and we don't want that to happen.
Yeah. So I gather your father's there, Andy Vanacek. Can I have a quick word with Andy, your dad?
Yes.
Sure.
Hi, Andy.
Hi.
Thanks for having us. Yeah, pleasure. What were you thinking when Saga held up this sword that she found in this lake?
To be honest, I thought she was kind of wasting my time because I wanted her to bring that buoy out to me. And I was just like a little bit impatient. But then I saw it kind of bend in one spot, the gravity of her lifting it up after being underground for 1,500 years or whatever. It just kind of bent. And then I realized that's not a stick. So I kind of ran up to her, and then I saw what she saw, the tip and the length and the handle. And I was just like, oh my goodness, let me hold that so it doesn't break anymore.
Right.
So I got, she was like, we were bringing it to shore, and she was like, I want to hold it. And I was like, no, that's okay. I think Daddy better take care of this now.
So Saga is American, grew up in Minnesota. It sounds like you're American too. Am I wrong?
No, you're right. I grew up in Minnesota. Met my wife 20 years ago. She's from Sweden. So we moved back. I lived in Sweden for 6 years previously. And then we moved back after 10 years in Minnesota just last year.
Yeah, and I have to ask you about your daughter's name, Saga. That word just evokes this whole era when the sword presumably was made. It's almost like your daughter, Saga, was destined to find the sword.
You know, I'm starting to wonder that too. It's almost like, did we choose the name or did the name choose us?
Saga, I imagine those archaeologists are going to be super protective of the sword, and you may never touch it again. Will you always remember, though, what it felt like in your hand? And maybe can you just describe what it felt like in your hand?
It felt very rusty and like stones, kind of.
Felt like stones.
What did you feel like when you raised it up in the air? Because, you know, you screamed, you yelled. What did you say to me when you raised it up in the air?
I said, Daddy, I found a sword! That's bad.
Saga, thank you so much for sharing your story with us about finding the sword, and keep looking for other stuff. It may be simply amazing what you do find.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks
for having us.
I had so much fun talking to them. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman, back with you here tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.